Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Environmental Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mohammed Gamaluddin, the host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Dr. John Cardina about his new book, Lives of Weeds, Opportunism, Resistance, Folly. Dr. John Cardina grew up in Northeast Ohio. He developed an interest in plant ecology while hiking in the woods and working on farms and gardens. He holds degrees in plant sciences from Ohio State, Virginia Tech, and Penn State. He has spent 35 years conducting research on weed ecology and environmental science, and is now a professor emeritus with Ohio State University. Dr. John Cardina, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Great. Great to have you. So let's just jump in. John, I was wondering if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself, that is, where you were born, raised, where you went to school, how you became interested in weeds and environmental history or environmental science, and whether you had a mentor or scholarly work that drove your research interest.
Sure, I'd be happy to talk about those things. So I was born in the state of Ohio, and to a couple of parents who my father had a rural background and worked in nurseries and knew a lot about trees and flowers and things like that. And my mother came from the city and was a learner of all that stuff, but became quite a good gardener herself. And so I grew up there in Northeast Ohio and had the great opportunity to spend a lot of time hiking in the woods. I learned the names of so many trees and other plants, and I always developed this curiosity about them, how it is that they did what they did and turned color and made flowers and fruits and all these things. And I also had the great opportunity to work on farms in my area, various farms making hay or helping on vegetable farms and things like that. So I was close to plant science most of my life. And I'm one of six children, and for some reason, the others were more clever and somehow were able to get out of doing the farm work. So I was the one that my father always tapped to work side by side with him, hoeing or tilling the garden, whatever we were doing. I seemed to always be the one who was left without some other excuse for what I was doing. So, but that, of course, was great training and led me to major in agronomy as an undergraduate at Ohio State University. I never had any intention of studying weeds, but I was always had this curiosity about them because of how they just, they were always there, no matter what we did to try to suppress them. They always came back, and that resilience had a real interest in me. And I always wanted to know the names of all the plants. So learning weeds was a great way to learn the plant families and the different characteristics of various families. So when I traveled the world, had opportunity to do some travel, I would look at the vegetation wherever I was, and at least I could, even though I don't know the plant, I could at least tell what family it was in and something about its biology from that. And so I did some work in graduate school at Penn State. I worked on a project looking at the impact of herbicides, chemical herbicides used to control weeds, and their impact on microorganisms, soil microorganisms, specifically rhizobia that are important for legumes for fixing nitrogen. And that led me into that world of the herbicide end of weeds. And so those two came together. And frankly, when I got out, that the jobs were in weed science, not in plant physiology or other things that I was maybe thought I was more interested in. But it was a great turning point and opportunity for me to do that, to get a chance to work with weeds, because the more I worked with them and with farmers who are concerned about them, the more I found that farmers have a real interest in managing weeds, and that gardeners seems to be sort of one of the things that brings people together all the time, is to talk about the latest weed problem that's out there. As for mentors, so many people helped me along the way. No specific mentor, someone I followed, but I worked with farmers who just had incredible wisdom about the plants that they managed, and people who know so much about the natural world. And I just sort of envied their connection to those things and how they seemed to be able to put things together on the connection between plants and animals and their environment. And I saw that in other people, and that's what I think drove my interest in the environmental science.
Fascinating. Thank you for that. My next question comes back to the book at hand, and it's more general. How did you come to write Lives of Weeds?
Well, after working with plants, weeds in particular, most of my life, observing, studying, and pulling weeds, I came to see them in a different perspective, not just as these pestiferous sort of plants to be gotten rid of, but as the social connection is so strong with them. Everyone who does things outdoors has some connection with weeds. They're in your way, or you find them lovely, or about the things that the medicinal properties or what parts can be eaten. So there's this real connection to weeds, and I sort of saw weedy plants as a social and cultural phenomenon as much as a biological curiosity. So I wrote the book sort of to explore biology and history behind the ambiguous and sort of contradictory relationship that people have with the plants that they consider to be weeds.
Yeah, and I think that really stands out in your text. Definitely the interaction, the human interaction, which I'll get to in a few. But first, John, I was hoping you could paint a picture for our listeners about why you have chosen only 8 weeds to focus on: dandelion, Florida beggarwood, velvet leaf, nutsedge, marestail, pigweed, ragweed, foxtail. Each one helps you to tell a story. Can you give us insight into why these weeds?
Sure. Well, many times people talk about weeds just in general as though they're all the same. So I wanted to highlight differences and demonstrate that they're all unique, like we are all unique. You talk about people, but people are unique. So these are weeds. I had a purpose for each one. And each of these are weeds that I worked with in a research capacity. So I conducted research at some level or have some kind of a personal connection with all of them. The book is about this connection between people and weeds, and me being in the people category, I had to show how I am personally related to those weeds. So I have personal stories in every chapter in all of them, and my connection, it demonstrates my connection to them. So then beyond that, I also wanted the book to be instructive in plant biology, plant ecology. So they all also gave me an opportunity to represent different features of plant biology. So I could talk about dispersal mechanisms or breeding systems or basic genetics or photosynthesis and sort of allocate those for each of the chapters, the species that I thought best demonstrated that scientific information.
And I think that really showed through where each one had a specific story, history, and it really helped to degeneralize this, you know, large classification of just anything that wasn't a crop or a flowering plant as a weed. And I think the readers will be really appreciative of that, especially those who are looking for something beyond the generalization about, you know, what these these strange plants that pop up among crops or grasslands.
Right. And like I say, I also tried to demonstrate how people are not only my connection, but people, that there is a history, a great human connection on each of these, so that none of them would have become weeds without the help of human activity and selection or in some cases, mostly good intentions, but sometimes it didn't always go the right way.
Exactly. And how our conception of weeds change, what is a weed, changes over time with our conception of what's important or what is a weed or what is not a weed. So my next question is about your research methodology. Can you tell our listeners what sources you use to write this history of weeds? Most importantly, it is part personal ethnography and your own experience in a field. And if you could say, how important was your 35 plus years of fieldwork to writing the text?
Well, certainly it was important because it gave me a background into those species. I couldn't have drawn on a species that I didn't know anything about, probably, and done justice to it, because I really wanted that personal connection. And because of that personal connection, I knew things about the weed, that species, that maybe were a little offbeat, that stories I'd heard or things that I had experienced on farms or in gardens. So that was important. But also, writing the book was an enormous learning experience. I learned so much about these species because there were obviously things that I didn't know. I didn't know all the history and all the connections and all the personalities of the people involved. That was one thing that was like when I would get to some a person connected with this particular species, I wanted to know more about that person, not just, oh, this was so-and-so had this role, but who was that person really? And so that drove me I looked as much into the history and anthropology literature as I did into the biological literature for each of these species. There's a great resource called the Biological Heritage Dictionary or resource website, Biological Heritage website, and that is an incredible place where I could look at texts written in the 1500s and to go back and find historical information. They were even searchable sometimes. So that's just incredible. And that raises the bar for the level of information that you're of depth of, study that one needs to do, I think, now to understand something.
Thank you. And I would say it really shows through, especially when you talk about your experiences with various farmers or NGOs or people in the at the forefront of crop cultivation who are dealing with weeds daily, and those experiences really help to shape the narrative, if I may say. Now, you already hinted at this and spoke a little bit about it, but in almost every chapter, you describe the human-plant interactions that have led to the explosion of a particular weed. A lot of times it is because a weed was once cultivated as a crop and planted across the country for various reasons. For example, like dandelion or the velvet leaf. And thus they became a part of the seed bank. In other cases, it was connected to human movement. Now, finally, how are weeds a lens into the ways man-made actions can influence the Earth's ecology?
Right. So weeds are a lens, the way I see it, in that they respond in very predictable ways according to plant evolution and plant biology. And the ironic thing is that humans sometimes don't pay attention to that. So in spite of all the knowledge on how evolution occurs and how selection happens and how species change over time, we sort of ignore that in the way we try to manage weeds in agriculture. So keep making the same mistake over and over. That's sort of the story in particular of the pigweeds. Keep making the same mistake over and over until things just get worse and worse, and we get to a point where they're selecting biotypes, genotypes that are very, very difficult to manage. So that's how I see it, is that weeds are these well-known and emblems of plant evolutionary biology that people are quite familiar with. And so if we just need to learn our biology and pay attention to it, I guess is how I see it.
Could you speak to some of the story, for example, with like the dandelion and its historical importance and uses in the early modern or pre-modern periods, and then how it was cultivated even in the 19th century, and how that has that spurred its integration into the American landscape.
Sure. So the human connection with dandelion is ancient. We don't know when it began, but we just assume that early humans were intrigued by this yellow flower and those white puffs, and what, after all, you see this, what child isn't intrigued by that and wants to stop along the path and blow on the dandelion? So I imagine, you know, early humans were intrigued by that. Then they found that actually the leaves were edible. Certain when the plants were young, people could use the grind the roots and as medicine, and so I think that just the sort of the appearance of it intrigued humans, and then people would take them along with them. There are stories that people had them in their apron pockets on the Mayflower because they were used as a medicinal plant or as a vegetable plant. So early in American colonial times, they were grown in gardens. And in fact, there were several varieties that were selected and in seed catalogs and named. And and I don't want to, I think to readers also need to know that the food green that is available in grocery stores, when we call dandelion, is not the dandelion, the weedy dandelion. It's a different species. It's cichorium. It's like a chicory. It's not the taraxacum that became a weed. So those are two different animals, sort of. But the weedy dandelion, then it was highly prized until people sort of developed this notion that they needed to have a pristine green lawn, and then suddenly the dandelion was offensive. Having yellow interrupt the green, and then particularly then when the yellow turned gray, that was objectionable. And so they went through all kinds of methods, including different kinds of machines to chop off the dandelion flowers, and the mixing up kerosene and other very toxic materials to try to in an effort to kill dandelions. So here again, this is where, you know, knowing a little bit about the plant biology, we should know that the more you'd do those kinds of things, there are going to be some that survive, and the survivors, likely survive because they have the genetic capacity to tolerate whatever it is that you're using to kill them. And they're the ones that propagate. They're the ones that have progeny that become the next generation. And so over time, the more we try to kill the dandelions with gasoline or kerosene or flames or sulfuric acid or whatever kinds of crazy things, salts that people want to throw at them, the more we're making dandelion a hardy plant. And so it came to in the 1940s when they history briefly about the sort of an aftermath of the Second World War. They had these materials called 2,4-D, and it did a great job of controlling most broadleaf weeds, including dandelions, if it was done right. But that just became the spur for this whole big industry that is still out there now, the chemical herbicide industry. And dandelions were sort of like the key weed that stimulated the development of that industry. I can go on, but I'll let you drop in there.
Yeah, I'd love to have you continue. But I just was going to say that it really did stun me, some of the measures they took to try and rid lawns of dandelions, especially the kerosene and gasoline, which just in hindsight seems very ludicrous.
Well, especially in because the dandelion itself does no harm. I mean, here's a plant that really, it isn't poisonous. It doesn't, a weed, in some places in agriculture, weeds are incredibly serious, that farmers lose their livelihood because of a weed, or there's some places where they make agriculture production impossible. But a dandelion does nothing like that. It isn't harmful. It's just this why it's a symbol. It's an indication of how humans use symbols. That with this botanical entity becomes now a symbol of a curse. When it really is not causing any problem, and so people are willing to put questionable materials, pesticides on them that really have potential to cause environmental and health problems. They were willing to do that to get rid of something that isn't really an environmental or health problem. And that sort of shows the irony, the folly of the title of the book, of human involvement in making a plant a weed. All of the weeds aren't that way. Some are very serious, but that particular one I thought was such a great example of how humans, you know, construct the weediness from just as a reflection of cultural values.
Exactly. And I think your readers will appreciate that. And this connects nicely, I think, to my next question on herbicide. So reading it, I was thinking about, you know, my neighbors who use herbicide to rid their lawns of weeds with little consideration of the effects, effects of the chemicals in the subsoil and waterways. Now, you discussed the reliance of herbicides in suburbia and farmlands from the U.S. to West Africa and termed this the herbicide treadmill, which I think is a really great wording for what's happening. But can you describe the history of herbicides in plant and weed control and the alternative measures you have promoted, including biological ways or what you call the integrated pest management system?
Sure. So the humans have been trying to suppress weeds since the beginning of agriculture. They've been using physical means. Imagine early on, just using physical means, pulling or sharp stones or sharp twigs or things like that to get rid of weeds. Well, imagine once if someone discovered that actually there was some material like salt that they could use, and that would you know, suppress these weeds. That was like a real technology change. And so over the millennia, people have tried all kinds of things to selectively suppress the weeds and let the desirable plants grow. Salts were used, many different kinds of salts were used for years, things that that we now would just consider way more toxic actually than the materials that farmers are using now. And with the development of organic chemistry, it was discovered that you know people could synthesize a molecule that did not previously exist. Organic chemistry is all about. Then you find you could actually synthesize a chemical that will suppress one group of plants and not another. And that's where, for example, that's where I said 2,4-D came in as a group of auxins that suppress broadleaf weeds without affecting grasses. That was considered miraculous at the time. And then, so that started in like late 30s, early 40s. And so by 1949, those materials in the early 50s were available to farmers. And that just changed agriculture. It allowed farmers to farm much larger areas of land. And the idea that you could just spray this stuff on a field instead of spending hours and hours, you know, with a slow driving tractor pulling this tillage equipment, that was really considered to be a great technological advance. And so over time, these chemicals have just gotten more sophisticated and more specific. Here again, this is where we get into knowing a little bit about plant biology. The early, like salt, would desiccate the plant. But a more modern herbicide will attack one specific enzyme that occurs in one group of plants. I mean, that's a big technological advance. But the more we do that, you can get more and more specific. Then the more likely we're able to, the plant is able to find a way to respond to it. It's hard to respond to develop. There's not likely to be evolutionary pressure that plants will be able to selectively have a genotype that survives, say, being, you know, cut off or yanked out of the ground, because that's just too big of a disruption of the biological processes going on in the plant. But if it's a very specific attack from your control method, where you're just going after one molecule, then there's likely to be genetic variation in that species so that some of them, a few of them, will be able to tolerate it. And therefore, you know, over time, we're selecting the plants that are either tolerant or resistant to the herbicides that are being used. And so my response to that as a researcher was my interest in weeds was not on the herbicides. I wanted to find alternative approaches to managing weeds. And I just thought there has to be something out there. And so let's look at plant processes. Like, how is it that weeds are able to survive? There have to, and you look around, the world is not covered with weeds. There are things that are suppressing them. So what is it in nature that is keeping the weeds in check? And you find that it's things like they're fighting for survival with many organisms, with fungi and bacteria, many pathogens, many insects also are attacking the plants, and there's competition among them. Therefore, none of them actually become, you know, so successful that we can't have any kind of flower or crop or vegetable production. There are things out there in nature that are keeping the populations in check. So that's what I wanted to find and learn and try to exploit. So very early on, I started looking at plant pathogens as a means of suppressing weeds. And there was a a big movement in the 80s to find plant pathogens that we could take from the wild and culture in vats, just like you culture any kind of bacteria or fungi, and then spray it out on the field, and then you'd have in a way a biological control, the killing the weeds with a fungus rather than a synthesized organic chemical. That there was a lot of interest in that, and I participated in that, and had a patent on one particular organism. But what happens there is that creating a reliable plant disease is a very difficult thing. The plant pathologists have been, people who deal with plant diseases, plant pathologists have been trying to do that for experimentation purposes for a long time, and it's more difficult than you think. So there are very few products available that actually work that way. More likely, there are things like there may be a toxin from a fungus, and so that led me to looking for there are toxins that plants produce to suppress other plants. So we did some work on selecting and extracting different chemicals that were in seeds, red clover seeds, celery seeds, many different plants. You can actually make an extract and then use them essentially like people would a herbicide. But whether those are always necessarily safer or not can be in a question. And then the other thing that I spent a lot of time studying was seed dormancy. And what is it that wakes up a seed that's been lying for years in the soil and suddenly it decides to germinate? If we could keep it sleeping there in the soil, that would be really nice. And so we tried to do some experiments to see. We know that one of the factors that stimulate germination is light. So could we use the absence of light to our cultivation, to our tillage and things at night to keep the plants, those seeds in the soil and keep them from germinating? And it does work. The problem is that it doesn't work well enough. It works maybe 60% of the time. And for a farmer who's got thousands and thousands of dollars invested in a crop, they can't go with 60%. They need 99% reliability, and that's why they use the herbicides. But those are the kinds of things we experimented on. And my idea was not that we would solve all the problems with these, but that they would be part of an integrated approach. They call this integrated pest management, where you try to use all the biological methods possible to favor the crop, to make the crop healthy and to suppress the weeds before you then have to rely on something that a rescue treatment from a herbicide. And if you're lucky, sometimes, maybe 60% of the time, you can get by without having to use the herbicide at all. So that's the rationale behind that.
Now, in a number of chapters, you touch on colonization and its historical impact on plant ecologies globally. From the ways in which colonial powers removed plants and burned landscapes to grow cash crops, but also in our contemporary period, you say, "I couldn't help wondering if dependence on imported pesticides, GMO seeds, and steel machines that run on diesel and oil wasn't just another kind of colonialism." Could you expand on colonialism's connection to weeds and their history, and how today some of our foreign agricultural policies are a new type of colonialism?
Right. Thank you for asking that question. I really appreciate that. because that's something that an issue that's sort of dear to my heart. That, you know, one of the things that happened in colonialism is that the colonized people become dependent. They become dependent on the colonizers. The colonizers provide goods and the economy is taken over by the colonizer who provides things that so that the colonizing power makes money on that, and the colonized people end up sort of being subservient after all, right? And I guess what my point was that in some places, people trying to modernize, I'm not sure I really like that word, but just to try to adopt so-called modern agricultural methods, mechanical, industrial agriculture methods as a way to improve the standard of living, end up being dependent on the sources of the modern tools, right? So if you want to modernize by using tractors and you don't make tractors, then you're dependent on somebody else to sell you those tractors, and you've got to come up with the foreign exchange to purchase those tractors. And the same thing happens when you try to modernize and say, well, the idea of having people out there hoeing and bending over and hoeing, that's a subservient thing. We don't want people doing that. We want to relieve them of that burden, which is a noble thing. But when you replace that now with chemical industrial technology, that you have to get from overseas, or you have to get it from a multinational corporation, now, once again, you're dependent on them for that, and you have to come up with the cash to purchase that. It isn't something that's done indigenously. So that's the connection that I'm trying to make there. And it's a dilemma. It's a really hard dilemma, because we understand that people want to raise their standard of living, and I'm all for that, and because that allows people to be educated, and that's so important. The problem is, if we do that in a way that makes them now dependent on someone else, what have we gained? It's a really complicated issue.
It is indeed, and something that we see happening across the entire continent as foreign countries are trying to industrialize agriculture for their own nation's consumption. I'm glad that you spoke about it in a number of places in your text, and hopefully and I know others are working on this, but it could be connected. Your work can be connected to what they're doing. Kind of touching on plasticity or resilience, in the epilogue of your book, John, you say, and I quote, "Resilience of plants reflects the resilience of nature, in which we and weeds are inextricably entangled." Could you expand on this and how you actually have hope based on our experiences with COVID in the last couple of years and climate change?
Okay, well, but the hope is that there is capacity out there for people to change the way they do things. what happened during COVID, at least for a while, initially for, you know, the few months there in 2020, was that things slowed down, that people, I know that's a created economic crisis. I totally understand that. But when in the process, we used fewer resources, we didn't travel as much, we didn't use as much petroleum and products. And the thing, what showed me is people are capable of doing that. They're capable of making change, even though it's difficult. And the only way we're going to survive the climate crisis is if we make some changes. We can't go about it and just think, oh, the technology will just get better, and so we can keep going about living the way we always have been at the same standards of pace of things and do all the things we've always been doing and somehow survive this. People have to be willing to make change. And what I've found in that particular part of the book there is, after looking back on agriculture and seeing that, you know, in the very same place where now there is, you know, high resource use agriculture, at other times in history, people have lived viable, healthy, happy lives without that. So people have survived without all the fancy technology, and so that without all the oil consumption, without all the excessive, consumption of the Earth's resources, it's possible for us to do that, and we can still live viable, good lives without the latest gimmicks and things. That's sort of where the hope comes. That it is possible to do that. So it's just up to people to make a choice. And the choice begins sort of as what you eat. Do you eat food that comes from high consumption of resources, you know, corn-fed beef, or do you eat something that is grown locally and grown with less use of resources? It's possible. People change, and that's what's hopeful, is that people can change.
This last question connected to your text may sound a little pessimistic, but it's sort of connected to what you were just speaking about. But I must ask, because you cite the example of the Amish smallholder farms and kind of hold them up as one of the Jeffersonian ideals that we could look towards. But why can we not force through legislation, or can we, through legislation or social movements, industrial farming to change its practices with herbicides and pesticides? It seems like every chance you were given to influence change was met by the need to produce solutions to weeds quickly and grow crops efficiently. Can we slow these processes down to where a new system of weed and pest management could be introduced?
Right. This is one of these real big dilemmas where how do you move a great big system around? How do you slow down something that's moving so fast and is so mammoth? I'm not hopeful that we can that can be done easily in a legislative sense, because the politics is such a mess. I think it only can happen by individuals making change. And if individuals make change and refuse to buy the food that's produced one way or another, or they stop traveling so much, needless travel, when they could walk, take a bicycle, take public transportation. When people make their personal changes on behalf of the environment and their future and their children's future, then we won't need legislation. It'll change out of necessity, because the markets, if you know, in the capitalist system, this is how it works. The markets will respond. And we see this with electric vehicles. I mean, the demand for electric vehicles now is enormous. It's can't be filled, and so we didn't need legislation to make that happen. But I think people's concern for the environment and not wanting to buy oil from various places stimulates that. So I think the same thing has to happen with food and agriculture.
Definitely agree. So on that note, let's remind people to take charge of their own pantries and change the way that they interact with the earth, and we'll be able to have better days, hopefully. Well, John, I've taken up a lot of your time, but as a pleasure is all mine. But to conclude, if I may ask you, what are you working on now?
Okay, so I've explored several things, and one is I'm sort of working on a chronicle of urban gardens. That's where I think that in urban areas, the idea of people being able to produce, they're not going to totally feed themselves, I know, but at least they can produce something and then get an appreciation for the natural world by their connection to the plants in a garden. So I'm trying to chronicle how a garden changes and what's possible to do. And there's so much great stuff out there, people in urban areas doing that, and it's not only biology and agriculture, it's community. There's so much community building that happens at the same time, so that's sort of keeping me with the plant human connection.
Sounds fascinating. As someone who resides in an urban area, I look forward to really reading that text. And if it's just as engrossing as Lives of Weeds, I'm sure I'll enjoy it, and our readers will enjoy it. Finally, I just want to thank you for being on our show today. I really enjoyed the conversation and the book, and I hope you take care.
Thank you so much. It's been great talking to you.